Welcome to the 57th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as the rest of the world focuses on the potential outbreak of World War III in Ukraine, welcome to the podcast that's only concern is the state of the wicked at the St. Lawrence ground.
There's something about spring, isn't there, where there's a kind of sense of optimism about everything in life, and particularly all things cricket. Personally, I've been quite pleased at the way that the ECB have taken on that sense of optimism with the appointment of Peter Moores. I was slightly worried that they were going to think, no, Peter Moores comes with too much baggage. He's done the job before. He was chucked out after a massive falling out with probably England's foremost player of the last, 10 years in Kevin Peterson. But they haven't. They've made a solid statement. They've gone forward. They've appointed Moores. And actually, I think that the boldness of that decision is quite a good thing in England.
One thing I've read about the appointment that I think is very fair is that one of the reasons they've been able to bring him back is because his exit the first time was so dignified. He didn't sort of do this tell-all autobiography. He actually just went back to cricket, worked really hard, pulled off something impressive with Lancashire. And that it's a kind of an interesting lesson, I suppose, for a lot of sportsmen. I guess a lot of people in other contexts of life, actually, there's a lot to be said for going in the right way. It may present you opportunities later. Do you think it was fair on Giles?
Well, I personally think that if they had appointed Giles, it would have been a bit of a sort of retroactive step. He was the kind of inevitable successor. He had the one-day coaching berth. And actually, it would have been the easiest thing to have done to have appointed Ashley Giles. But actually, I think it was clear. You know, Giles has only been coaching since, I think, 2007. And I just don't think he has the experience. I think, you know, Peter Moores is clearly the standout person for the job. And the only way for English cricket really to revive itself on the international level is to have this kind of concerted effort in a particular direction. And so I think that, you know, in a sense, I'm just glad that the English establishment have come out strongly and in a unified way, but behind one individual rather than just having a kind of, you know, an ongoing debate about who it should be.
And I think the unity is the key point because him and Alistair Cook seem likely to be.
They are so unified that they actually have become
family.
One.
Yeah, no, well, I think that there seems a lot of evidence to suggest they'll get on well, build an effective relationship, and that's going to be key.
Okay, so you've referred to the St. Lawrence ground down in Kent. I haven't seen any county cricket so far, having been in Sydney. What's caught your eye so far?
Well, it says a lot about how desperate us England fans were in the Ashes that there were some fans who were actually calling for England to play a 20-year-old fast bowler who had finished the previous county season with just 6 wickets at 66 runs apiece. But it's very easy to understand why people get excited about Tim R. Mills, who I hope I'm pronouncing correctly. His Twitter page actually says, "You will pronounce my name wrong," which I probably have fulfilled that prophecy. He's a fast bowler at Essex. And, you know, there are lots of promising fast bowlers at any one time in England. You know, there's always going to be a production line. There aren't many who hit 90 mile an hour with the ease that he does and sort of very smooth action that he does. But I think what's been exciting about the start of the county season is he's really left the winter's hype behind him, where he was bowling in the nets with the England batsmen in Australia. He's left that behind him and he's got back to sort of hard work in the county championship second division. He's taken an important 3 for 49 to set up Essex's win over Derbyshire. And I think it's always interesting watching a prospect. But in Tamal Mills' case, it's going to be fascinating. He's got this extraordinary gift at bowling, you know, absurd speed, very aggressive. But it's really being able to bring the accuracy to that. And how is he going to do that without compromising that threat, without compromising that hostility? And I think that's going to be fascinating to watch.
Now, it's interesting that you talk about this kind of whole thing of seeing players in county cricket and watching them kind of come through in the sort of nuances of player that the statistics don't add up to much, but having seen them, you're able to actually get excited about them. Because one of the things that I've kind of realised now living in Sydney is that kind of thing of always being aware of what's happening in the background in county cricket. I mean, I've never had a county side in my life. I've never lived in a county that has a first-class side attached to it. And so I've never really had that kind of strong following for county cricket. I love cricket, and so I sort of follow the county game generally. But one of the things that I've kind of realised since being down here is that I'm not going to, you know, be in that sort of culture, as it were, which you're exactly just talking about, where people are kind of rumouring about particular players and things like that. And, well, I mean, it was kind of struck home to me when I was remembering something that the late Christopher Martin Jenkins said, which is that you can't understand the international game without understanding the domestic game, or without having a real sort of insight into the domestic game.
I'd argue that one of the problems, though, is that within the media now, that international-domestic divide has been blurred to the point where when the BBC sports pages cover county cricket, it's nearly always in the context of an England player or an England hopeful player doing well. And I think it's a little bit of a shame because it's forgetting the fact that actually this is an interesting, exciting competition, and we need to cover it first and foremost, I think, in the context of that, you know, who's doing well, who isn't. And I think it's a bit of a shame. I saw in the first day of the season, it was all about all Pryors made 100, all Bells made 100. It's interesting, but that actually should
be the headline. And similarly with Jonathan Trott, you know, that headline is kind of the only thing that I've heard about the fact that Jonathan Trott has kind of has made himself absent from the game again with the stress-related, in inverted commas, illness that he has, is the only thing that I've heard. So you're right that there's not a kind of sense of cricket for cricket's sake. Now, talking of cricket for cricket's sake, obviously for me it's the end of the season. It's the autumn here down in the Southern Hemisphere, but the village cricket season is just warming up for you.
So yesterday was supposed to be the first game of the season. And for anyone who has been, you know, who lives in England, it's been a stunning week. It's been beautiful, building up to, you know, it should have been crescendoing up to Sunday. I wake up on Sunday and you've just never seen anything like it. The sky was just an eternity of grey. It poured for about 10 o'clock onwards. Our intrepid village captain went to the ground at 11, apparently stood there watching it rain for an hour before eventually giving up and calling the game off. And I thought it was another one of these reminders about how cricket teaches us sort of much more, even those of us who play it at a useless level. You know, you build up to the season, you have all the anticipation, and then you wake up and it's raining. And cricket's a wonderful sport for teaching us about dealing with failure and dashed expectations, which, you know, is crucial to life in general.
For many of us, the 2005 Ashes was the most memorable Test series of all time. But who was it who turned that series? Many people would say it was Flintoff. Some would go for Kevin Peterson, while others might pick out the reverse swing of Simon Jones. But there were some inside the England setup who believed that more credit should have gone to England's new bowling machine.
The story of Merlin the bowling machine is made much more compelling because it wasn't the multi-million creation of a major company, but it's the labour of love of just one inspired engineer. It took Henry Pryor 15 years of work in his shed in Wales to create Merlin, and it's got that lovely sort of British Heath Robinson feel to it, kind of mad inventor just ploughing away on his own thing. And it, what he created was the first bowling machine to convincingly replicate spin. Apparently an extremely complex structure. You know, the mechanism really was something of a work of art. And for England, the timing was perfect. You know, they were approaching the Ashes. They were desperate to beat Australia. And if they were going to do so, they had to beat Shane Warne.
What's quite interesting, at that point, actually, at that quite elementary point, is that bowling machines have been around for an awfully long time. I remember as a kind of 7-8-year-old facing in the mid-90s facing a bowling machine. And so it's interesting that actually it's only at this stage in the early 2000s that someone actually creates a bowling machine that can create spin to that effect.
Well, I think, my sort of most experience with bowling machines, and I'm sort of no engineer, is that you're basically firing something at speed. And I guess it's easy to envisage how firing an object at speed is a very different thing to actually getting the kind of complex turn on it. The other thing I should say about Merlin is that it uses proper cricket balls. Now, most of us who've faced the pain of a bowling machine, you get used to being hit with these horrible sort of big plasticky things that actually...
I hadn't realised that. The ones with the dimples in that give you the kind of, the telling cherries, well, not even cherries, green marks usually on your bat with the...
And
people know that they haven't been born. Yeah, no, they do.
Yeah. So the England players were queuing up to say how much of a help it was. Flintoff was particularly complimentary. Ashley Giles went as far as to say that without it, England would probably have gone 2-0 down at Edgbaston. Yet all this praise for Merlin slightly undermined by the brilliance of Warne. He took 40 wickets at 19 apiece in the series. He was by a distance the most successful bowler on either side. Troy Cooley, who was obviously then England's bowling coach, came out and said, well, without Merlin, Warne might have taken 60, which I think is stretching credulity, frankly. But what made it clear is that Merlin hadn't solved Warne. That being said, the ECB were very, very taken with it. It was clear that Merlin couldn't be manufactured on a large scale because of the complexity of it. So Henry Pryor began work with Bowler, who, if you've seen any bowling machine, it was probably built by them. They're the main manufacturer. And they managed to create a simplified mechanism which achieved the same effect. The ECB promptly distributed one of these models to every first-class county in an attempt to sort of improve the national playing of spin bowling.
Okay, so here's... I suppose the big question around all of this is the whole thing on which this whole exercise stands or falls is the question of whether a spin bowler achieves more out of the kind of technicalities of his craft, the ball landing in a particular place, but spinning in a particular way, as opposed to the mental part of being able, because this Warne question is a really interesting one, because Warne, as they say, got inside the head of bowlers. And is that kind of, is that the thing that sort of makes or doesn't make Merlin this question of whether facing spin bowling is a purely technical thing or whether actually there's a mental thing that a machine can never achieve?
Well, this is the thing, because on the technical measure, Merlin wins. I mean, David Parsons, who's England's performance director, talks about how Merlin can get more spin than any spin bowler ever can. He talks about this being kind of overloaded training. The batsman's facing something harder than they'll ever face. So on the technical side, it wins. There's a lovely interview with James Taylor, which if you fancy an interesting 7 minutes on YouTube. And again, he seems slightly in awe of Merlin's technical ability. He talks about it being obviously very consistent because it's a machine, which is obviously hard to disagree with. And there's no question, I think, then that on the technical side, Merlin pulls it off. But I think you're quite right to point out this mental aspect. And there's a lovely quote that sums this up from the late Terry Jenner, the Aussie spin guru and mentor of Warne, who says that facing Merlin is artificial, like making love to a statue, which I think perfectly captures this idea that you don't face a machine in the middle. You face a bowler. And what has always made Shane Warne in particularly difficult was his ability to nag English batsmen. I mean, he often would say Warne took many, many wickets with straight balls that didn't spin at all. What got him those wickets was the uncertainty he'd created in the mind of the batsman, and the sort of the theatre almost around Shane Warne bowling.
Would it be kind of callous to make a comparison with seam bowling machines? Because teams that have access, as they have for years, to a bowling machine that will put a ball down on a good length in that corridor of uncertainty outside off stump. Bowling machines have been able to do that for a while, but yet that still gets wickets. I mean, it's theoretically speaking, it's quite clear that just having a bowling machine that does something doesn't make a team impervious to that kind of bowling attack.
I think the seam bowling thing is worth thinking about. I mean, we're about to talk about Michael Holding's autobiography. And if you think about facing a ball being fired out at 90 miles an hour from a bowling machine, or watching Michael Holding running in and playing a ball, that's a considerably different challenge. It's worth also noting there is an element of the technical side which a bowling machine hasn't been able to replicate, which Merlin hasn't been able to replicate. Ashley Giles talks about the fact that you need to read the bowler's wrist, and that with Merlin, you're just looking at a dirty great hole. And I think this is an interesting, and I guess in a way, it's quite reassuring. We haven't been able to build a machine or a robot that can quite replicate Shane Warne. And I guess the romantic in most cricket fans will probably be quite happy with that. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading No Holding Back, the autobiography of Michael Holding. Whispering Death, as he's known, was a key fast bowler for the very successful Windies team of the 70s and 80s, and has gone on to become a very successful broadcaster.
So the first half of the book deals with his playing career for the West Indies and for various club sides. And then the second half of the book deals with two things. Firstly, with his time as an administrator, both on various boards for Alan Stanford and for various boards for the ICC. And then a couple of chapters that deal with his thoughts about cricket in general. Personally, I think those last few chapters are the least successful, the ones where he's sort of pontificating upon cricket in general. But the rest of the book is bound together by his sort of sense of honesty, I suppose, really, that characterised him both as a player and as an administrator, the fact that he's never afraid to speak his mind. And what I like about this book is the fact that we have someone who's in a sort of inside position within the cricket world, but yet is being completely honest about their thoughts.
I think he comes across very well from his interactions with the ICC. He resigns from this particular ICC committee after the ICC completely arbitrarily, it seems, with no consultation, decide to change the result of the Pakistan-England, that infamous Pakistan-England, the Darryl Hare test, from a England victory to a no, sort of a no-result game. And He, the integrity with which he kind of carries himself through that and his resignation from that, I think he emerges very well. But it was also very interesting the extent to which his peers emerge extremely poorly. Their willingness to sort of speak out in private and not in public, to kind of not rock the boat, is quite noticeable, and is also quite, you wonder, maybe quite indicative of how a lot of the ICC works.
Well, I was actually quite glad to have read this book, because actually I felt that I learned quite a lot about some major incidents in the recent past of cricket that I hadn't learned otherwise. Similarly, Michael Holding is one of those people who, you know, whenever you watch the Sky commentary, there he is doing his thing. And similarly, you have these kind of images of him in the past. One of them is when he's kicking the stumps over during that New Zealand test match in 1970, whatever it is, you know, that iconic image. The other one is of him, as you said, whispering death, running in, bowling, terrorizing English batsmen, you know, Brian Close getting hit everywhere, etc., etc. Did you feel that similarly, that we were kind of learning new things about things that we already thought that we knew about with this book?
Yeah, I mean, I guess another iconic image is that greatest over, isn't it? That over he bowls to Boycott, where he kind of works Boycott all over before clean bowling him. And I think what was quite refreshing was to hear Holding's very modest reflection on that. And also, it taught you a lot about the way sportsmen have very little control over how their legacy is remembered. Holding reckons it wasn't even the best over he bowled in that game, let alone the match. But he recognises that far beyond his control or the control of anyone there, it's become idolised, it's become remembered in a way that actually bears very little resemblance to maybe what actually happened.
And similarly, in terms of the things that are and aren't remembered in terms of a cricketer's lifetime, the things that they've achieved, one thing that shamefully we have never remembered about Michael Holding is that he owns the best petrol station in the entirety of Jamaica.
Well, he's quite honest about it, isn't he? He hilariously says it was in such a terrible place that even his loyal customers would often get into car crashes trying to get there.
Because it was impossible to turn into it without having to turn across a lane of traffic and get pranged.
But this is a guy who's incredibly successful, was involved in Packers, so he made, you know, money out of that. But it's very useful to be reminded that actually he was playing cricket at a time where, coming to the end of his career, it wasn't a question of, I'll retire on my millions or whatever. It was, right, what am I going to do next? And I think it gives you a respect for the guy that he then went very much back from the international cricket scene to sort of running a gas station. And also, I think the honesty with which he talks about how hard that was, you know, the return to the real world, having to manage people. I mean, he talks about people nicking money from the till. And you think it must ground you in a way that very few modern successful cricketers ever kind of have to be grounded.
It's quite the sequence where he talks about his retirement is really interesting, because it's something that kind of occupies us quite a lot as cricket watchers, is how someone should retire. Should they do a Ponting, and should they kind of fade on the international circuit and kind of go past their best, or should they go out before they've reached their best, for instance? Holding, the sequence where he talks about that, he talks about the fact that he deliberately didn't want to get to, I think it was 250, but it was some landmark, I think 250, didn't want to get to 250 wickets before he retired, because he wanted to be able to show the world that he was retiring purely on his own terms. And he just woke up one morning and thought, I just can't be arsed with this anymore. Mm-hmm. And then got out of there, and then apart from that, his only consideration was, I do not want to get to 250 wickets, because otherwise it'll seem as if I'd just been gunning for that in order to sort of cling on.
I have to say, his retirement almost sounded extremely easy. It was that idea of, he just realised it was no longer fun. He realised, I think he said he actually wanted it to rain, he just didn't want to play. And I wonder, maybe it's just easier for some players than others. Maybe with some players, that desire does just go. I mean, I think it's consistently one of the interesting things in the book about how honest he is about his feelings for the sport. He talks about how it was never a dream of his to play at the highest level. He's very honest about that. And he actually suggests, well, maybe that was part of the reason for his success. He just played the game because he loved it and happened to get there.
We have a confession to make, which is the way that we've been choosing our books to review recently is that it's basically impossible to buy books on Amazon. So I have to go into Sydney's sort of one big bookshop, see what's there, buy it. Andy then buys it on Amazon back in the UK, and we review it. And Michael Holding came to us through that avenue. I think it's fair to say that we possibly wouldn't have picked it otherwise. My take on it is that I think it's definitely worth a read. It's annoying in places. There were definitely pages that I didn't read because he was ranting about 2020 cricket and the state of the West Indies, and it sort of all got a bit much. But I think we would probably certainly recommend it.
Yeah, it looks from the outside, I mean, certainly from the title onwards, like it's going to be a sort of paint-by-numbers cricket autobiography. But there's actually a lot more in it than that. To the interview, and this episode I spoke to freelance journalist Phil Harrison. Phil's written extensively as a critic for Time Out and recently wrote a superb piece for The Night Watchman on the interesting way in which cricket fans relate to the players they follow. You've just mentioned that this is the first piece you've ever really written on cricket, and I wondered what inspired you to move away from your kind of what you traditionally write about move on to cricket.
Well, I've always loved cricket. I've never particularly aspired to be a cricket journalist because mainly out of laziness, I think, because it's an incredibly difficult thing to get into, I think. But what often happens with me when I'm writing sort of extracurricular things is that I'll have an idea and develop it over quite a long period of time. It took me about 3 months in the making, that article, and then another sort of 6 months before the Night Watchman actually got back to me, to the point where I'd almost forgotten I'd sent it to them. But no, it really was literally just I was watching cricket and I started thinking about the things that I touched on in the article, and I jotted some ideas down, and it went on from there, really. It wasn't a conscious decision. I wasn't sort of thinking I'm going to now start writing about cricket. I just sometimes have ideas that are outside of my normal realm. So, yeah.
I guess, because we're really big fans of The Night Watchman. I think it's amazing what it's doing for sort of cricket writing. And, I mean, did you find it quite different to write for, I guess, compared to a lot of the other magazines? It seems to just give writers maybe more of an opportunity to just run with things. But
absolutely. I find it really liberating, to cheesy words, I guess. But it's lovely to be able to write something and know that you don't have to write to length particularly, and you can be quite digressive, and you can really just sort of say what's in your head, and you're not going to have an editor sort of saying to you, no, this needs to be 500 words shorter, or this needs to be more sort of focused on a particular angle or whatever. So no, I agree with you. I think it's a brilliant publication, and I hope it continues, because it's a lot of writing, isn't it, when you think of how regularly it is. I mean, there is a lot of good cricket writing out there, but I just hope they manage to sort of maintain the same standards that they have, because I was honoured to be in it, to be honest.
Yeah, well, because I guess with your experience in other parts of journalism, especially with Time Out, are you sort of surprised that something like The Night Watchman's kind of coming? Because it seems a lot like the opposite of a lot of the way journalism's going.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of in-depth, it's quite focused on, producing these quite nice paper copies. I know you can get it online. So, I mean, are you surprised, or do you think maybe there is going to be more room in journalism for something like that?
I think there will be. I just think that journalists are going to have to get used to not being paid for stuff like that.
Yeah.
I've noticed it in a couple of areas that I work in. There's a sort of spin-off magazine of Time Out called Delayed Gratification, which is a sort of quarterly magazine which is, as you said, printed on really nice paper, and it's sort of long-form pieces of the kind that don't really get into Time Out anymore. People who write for it don't get paid for writing for it, but they do get the freedom to sort of say what they want and say it at whatever length they want, within reason as well. And I think there will be more stuff like that. I just think you have to do it as a labour of love rather than as a way of sort of expecting to earn a living.
And I guess it's a slightly uncomfortable thing, that, isn't it? Because we've spoken to some people on the podcast who are sort of county cricket writers, and county cricket's a great example where I think it's going the exact way you're describing, where there's more and more of a feeling of people, right, you know, almost having to do it for the love of it.
Yeah.
And I guess for you as a freelancer, that's a bit of an uncomfortable balance, isn't it, between making a living and doing something for the love of it?
I mean, it's pretty worrying, to be honest. I went freelance about 3 months ago, and I've been freelance before, and I'm quite alarmed, to be honest, at how much harder it is now than it was when I was freelance six years ago. And I think it's probably the same, not just in cricket, but all through journalism and writing generally, that, you know, you it's so hard to earn a living at it now. It's so hard to actually get paid. And I think, I don't know, do you go on the Guardian County Cricket blog?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, I think that the level of sort of contributions, sort of both above and below the line on there, are pretty amazing.
Mm.
But I think that, you know, there's obviously people who blog on there who, you know, go to games and spend all day sort of reporting back and stuff like that. And I think that's how it will go, actually. I think things like county cricket, which are obviously not money spinners in any way, will become the province of sort of enthusiastic amateurs rather than sort of pros. I don't know how, for example, there would be a profit margin from a newspaper in sending reporters to cricket matches, to county cricket matches. So, I think it's probably on borrowed time in that sense, but I think the gap will be filled by amateurs.
No, it's really interesting to hear from someone who's got that experience, kind of, and it's particularly interesting to say that you've clearly noticed that it's got harder, because I think it's been a theme, actually, in quite a few of the people we've talked to. So I guess moving on to the article itself, because I think it struck both me and Toby, the co-host on the show. You talk about quite early on the way you were very into football for a while and then sort of returned to cricket. And you describe cricket as a gentler, less rapacious beast than football. Mm. I wondered if you could just expand on that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, football's... There's a sort of obvious intensity to football, isn't there, in the way it's supported, in the way the players behave and stuff like that. And I wouldn't want to be too much of a sort of moralist about it, because I do love my football. But I don't know. There's a sort of gentility to cricket that I quite appreciate, I think. And I think the game still just about maintains that, despite all the changes it undergoes. But also, I think there's a sense of sort of player loyalty in cricket that you get. Sort of that football has lost, really. I mean, footballers don't really tend to stay anywhere for much longer than sort of 3 or 4 years these days, do they?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, a county cricketer will probably have maybe 2 counties in the course of his career, and international cricket is still the most important form of cricket, and so you've got sort of people for the whole of their careers in that way.
Yeah.
Football, I guess the Champions League is becoming more important than internationals in a way. So, you know, it's quite hard to know where you stand with football some of the time, I think.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very interesting point, because you make the point in the article that, you know, you see a player, say, at your club, and you know that they have no necessary, like, long-term tie to your club if someone else comes in. I get, and you did touch upon there the fact that there are a lot of changes going on at cricket at the moment, because you made another interesting comment in your piece where you said that actually you had a kind of confidence and a faith that the underpinnings of cricket would always remain the same. There seems to be more angst at the moment than almost ever before amongst cricket fans about things like the IPL, things like Test cricket, things like the Big Three kind of interfering with the ICC. Are you still relatively relaxed about that, or do you think there is
not really? I'm trying to be. I'm not relaxed about it at all, because Test cricket is, as far as I'm concerned, the ultimate form of the game.
Mm.
And it troubles me to think that, you know, market forces might dictate that there's no economic future in continuing with it, and that the main countries won't want to play it anymore. Having said that, I suspect that people have been saying this about Test cricket since the mid-70s, really. And, you know, I've been watching cricket since about 1980, and I'm pretty sure that people have been saying stuff like this on a fairly regular basis since I started watching it. Having said that, I would say that probably at the moment it's facing the biggest existential threat I can think of in all that time. So I'm not completely relaxed about it, but hopeful, I would say. And I'm very worried about the big three thing, I have to say.
Yeah, but, yeah. Well, I think it's amazing the extent to which that almost happened without a lot of cricket fans really knowing what was going on. And it was almost only once it's done that people realised.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you make a really good point. I think there's a sense that Test cricket's always sort of seemed on the verge of crisis.
Yeah.
I guess what I think I've found really worrying of late is the way that aside from England and Australia, it's now becoming more and more acceptable to play kind of a two-test series here and there.
Yes.
It just doesn't feel quite right.
Yeah, I agree. I also think what's happening gradually is that countries like Sri Lanka and the West Indies and New Zealand are sort of drifting away from it. And, you know, those aren't big countries in terms of population, and they're not particularly big countries in terms of resources either. And, you know, I can't really blame a West Indian cricketer, for example, if the board isn't paying them from sort of saying, well, sod it, I'm going to go and play in the IPL.
Exactly.
You know, it's not their fault that the money doesn't come in the same way that it used to, or that it isn't paid as efficiently as it used to be. But it's not a good sign. And, you know, there's only sort of 10 test countries anyway. So, you know, it can't really afford to lose two or three, can it? I wouldn't have thought.
No, I think that's right. And I think it's going to be keeping those countries involved that's going to keep the game interesting is the real big challenge.
I mean, we were talking about the big three thing, and, you know, they have this sort of test fund or whatever it is that they're mooting. And I would say if I really thought they were going to stick to that, then it's not a bad idea on its own.
But
I don't really have any faith in it sort of being administered without fear of favour, almost.
No.
I suspect that there'll be ways found of sort of wriggling out of those responsibilities at some point down the line. I just don't trust the people running the game, to be honest.
Well, it just felt like such a power grab, and I think as you've just put very clearly, if we don't keep those sort of smaller nations involved and engaged, the game as a whole will just be so much less interesting.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
if you don't have a good West Indies, a good New Zealand team, it will just be a lot less interesting.
I mean, to be fair, New Zealand are looking better at the moment than they have done for years. But, I mean, this winter was a good example of this, actually, that, you know, we've just played an Ashes series in England and now we've played another one in Australia. And, you know, they must have been sick of the size of each other by the end of it. And I was pretty sick of watching games between England and Australia. Yeah. I never thought I'd say that, but I was just sort of fed up with it by then. So
it did certainly,
that will happen if they're not careful.
Yeah, it did certainly make it feel a lot less special.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, coming back to the article, I think the idea that really sort of struck a chord in the piece was this idea that of sort of cricket being this eternal constant. I really love this idea that, you know, you have one generation of players who you get attached to, but then they get replaced and, you know, you're getting older, but actually cricket's sort of still there.
Yeah.
And within that, you talked about the joy of sort of spotting a talented youngster and then seeing them kind of come on and really succeed. And I think that's, you know, a lot of our listeners could associate with it. What is special about that? What do you think makes that a kind of important part of following the game?
I mean, I think it is that idea of renewal, isn't it? And it's the idea of sort of not quite knowing what the future holds and whether you might be watching the emergence of a true great or you might be watching the emergence of someone who's going to play 25 tests and then never be seen again or something. But there's an element of sort of eternal, as you say, eternal renewal about it. And I don't know, I mean, there is a really vicarious side to all sports following, isn't there? And I don't know, when you see some amazing 20-year-old sort of making his first steps in the game, you can't help but sort of transpose a little bit of your own sort of desire to have done something similar onto them, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually didn't mention it in the article, but I did actually have trials at a county cricketer when I was a teenager and clearly wasn't good enough. But, you know, I sort of, there were people who I was trialled alongside who did actually turn into county cricketers, and I always kept an eye on them because I found it really interesting to see how they were doing. Everyone who follows sport kind of wishes on some level that they'd made it, don't they?
Very true.
I think you can do it vicariously. The idea
is it's a very sort of uncynical idea. You know, we're so good now at society, sort of putting people downward. And I think there's something lovely about the fact that as sports fans, people will get behind a youngster and just quite openly want them to succeed and want to win.
Yeah.
I think that there's some just really uncynical.
I think another thing, actually, sorry, I just you said earlier about the cricket being a gentler and less rapacious game. I think that applies more in cricket than most other sports to sort of cricketers of all nationalities as well. Mm. And I think that, for example, I sort of watched India in the T20 World Cup and watched Kohli play, and you sort of think to yourself, gosh, he's only 23, 24, and how good might he be in 5 years' time or whatever. And I think probably more than any other sport, cricket fans do appreciate people who play for other teams. And I think that's a nice thing. That's a really sort of positive thing about the game, actually.
Well, there's that lovely moment when you're watching a game live and someone from the team you're not supporting, you know, plays a great shot, and yeah. Everyone just instinctively pulls it. And that you're right, that's something that you're not going to get in a football context,
yeah.
Or at least
no, absolutely.
Very rarely. We're really, really interested that a kind of key player you talked about having a connection to is Mark Ramprakash, who for various reasons always seems to come up in this podcast, because he just seems like this great example. I think a lot of people connect with Mark Ramprakash, and I just wonder.
That's funny, that.
Well, there's something about, I guess from my perspective, it's something about the sort of how incredible it was to watch him play at his prime, but also that weird sense of, you know, having so much ability and never quite having made it. I mean, is that what do you think it is that makes him compelling for a lot of fans?
That's definitely a factor. I mean, he was a beautiful player, wasn't he? He was technically perfect and very easy on the eye and everything. And I remember when I first saw him, even though I was quite young, I remember thinking there's absolutely no way that this guy isn't going to be amazing.
Yeah, yeah,
and he was good, but he was never quite that good, was he?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think for me as well, because he's very nearly the same age as me, he's like 6 months older than me or something. So as I say in the piece, I became aware of him when I was first sort of doing things like going off to university and leaving home and getting my first jobs and stuff like that. Yeah. So it was almost like our lives in some daft way sort of overlapped each other somehow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I also think that he was probably the first, I might be wrong, but among the first British Asians to play Test cricket or play international cricket for England.
Yeah.
And at the time, I remember thinking, you know, this is going to be a rich new season of talent for English cricket to sort of utilise, and, you know, this is what the England cricket team is going to look like in 10 years' time, and that'll be a really great thing because, you know, it'll change the character of it slightly. And I don't think that's completely happened, but no, I think that's another reason why people perhaps really wanted Ramprakash to succeed in a way that he didn't.
To the debate, and this episode we're asking whether it's wrong for England to be attempting to take Paul Farbrace from Sri Lanka.
So having appointed Peter Moores as head coach, England are looking to bring in Sri Lanka's head coach, Paul Farbrace, as his assistant. We wouldn't be having this conversation, I don't think, if England were trying to poach a coach from, say, Australia, from India. But I think what feels really uncomfortable about this is the financial aspect. So Sri Lanka have notoriously struggled in the past to hold on to coaches and get the big name coaches because of this payment thing. They're not able to pay the money that a big can. So there is that sense of England kind of throwing their financial muscle around, which I certainly find uncomfortable about this. And I think it's more uncomfortable in the context of what happened a couple of months ago in Dubai.
Is it not just a case, though, of two kind of cricketing cultures clashing and the way that Sri Lanka works as a cricketing body sort of being exposed as being slightly inadequate? Because the fact is that Sri Lanka depends upon its players to play for it out of a sense of kind of national loyalty. Mm. You know, there are these reports about Sri Lankan players and its administrative staff not paid for months on them, being expected just to play because they're playing for their country, and, you know, they can tug their chest and all that kind of thing. And ultimately, that's not a very productive way to be running a setup. But actually, what Sri Lanka needs to do is they either need to play England at its own game and say, okay, we're able to play these people a full whack, or better, they're actually able to recruit coaches on their own terms. I mean, I don't really see why England aren't doing anything underhand. They are simply playing by their own rules. Sri Lanka are playing by separate rules. And on this occasion, England's rules are going to win out.
Well, I think there's two things there. I think, firstly, there's an understanding that Sri Lanka in the past haven't been able to get the top names. They've often tended to get coaches on the make, coaches sort of going somewhere, kind of potential prospects, which Paul Farbrace really fits that type. They've been able to give those coaches their first start, really, in international cricket. And I think what I guess is a little bit unfortunate is that he's come in and he's been there a few months. I mean, he's obviously had the incredible success already of the World 2020. But you wonder, well, maybe England would get more from letting him develop, letting him stay at Sri Lanka longer and then getting him involved. I mean, it's a thought. I think also this point about how England have done it. Couldn't we have done this whole thing slightly better? Wouldn't there be maybe more...
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we say that England are approaching him. We don't actually know that for certain at this stage. It's just rumoured. And certainly the Sri Lankan, apparently, according to the Sri Lankan board, the first that the Sri Lankan board heard about this was through the press. So that they weren't, you know, apparently England had gone to Farbrace and have been talking to him about coming in, but the Sri Lankan board haven't been approached at all, which does seem a little bit kind of underhand. I mean, the other kind of slightly unfortunate thing is just this sense that here's a man who the Sri Lankan players talk of as one of them, who seems to get on very well with everyone, who, as you say, has come up with this 2020 success, who's only just started a new contract, who started a new contract on the 1st of January, which is due to run until, I think, the middle of 2015. He is clearly kind of a leading light in Sri Lankan cricket at the moment, and yet he is going off to be the number two in England, and that kind of leaves a slightly better taste in the mouth, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I think you're quite right that look, if that's what he wants to do, if that where he wants is where the move he wants to make, then you can't really deny that. But there is also something a bit of a shame about, you know, Sri Lanka have tried to plan properly for next year's World Cup. They've tried to get a coach in there long term and in place for that, and that looks like it's going to be scuppered.
But going back to my earlier point. You say that they've tried to plan properly, but if they tried to plan properly, then surely they should be paying a coach enough that they want to stay. You know, it's fine to say on one hand, yes, it's scuppering Sri Lanka's plans because they've got presumably this kind of 3-year plan in place, of which Farbrace is a central part. But at the same time, you sort of think, well, they're kind of trying to have their cake and eat it if they're trying to do that without paying their coach properly.
Yeah, I just think, I mean, post, you know, everything that's gone on in the ICC in the last few months, I'm really not sure whether we can sort of talk about Sri Lanka even having the money to do that. And I mean, I think that's where the real worry comes here. Is this going to be part of an increasing pattern of the big three being able to sort of bully and take who they want coaching-wise, because ultimately they've got more money to throw at it? But I guess it also comes down to a question which I don't know the answer for, which is that, do England need to feel some sort of an obligation to sort of the broader game as a whole? And that's where I think it becomes really difficult. I mean, is there a broader obligation to sort of the health of the game? And I think in reality, the way it's going, that's less and less of a case.
I think there are two questions here. One of which, as you say, is exactly this thing about the broader obligation to the game. The other question actually is, we've been assuming all the way through that money is the key factor in all of this. But it's difficult to know whether it is, and it's difficult to know whether, you know, there's simply this thing that, you know, with coaches going off to Sri Lanka, a lot of coaches that go to Sri Lanka just end up saying, I miss my family, I want to go back to the UK or wherever. And so there is, I think, this problem with Sri Lanka that if they are going to keep on bringing in foreign coaches, they do leave themselves very vulnerable to those coaches then wanting to go back home, as it were, for whatever reason.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that still a country like Sri Lanka seems by default to be looking to appoint a foreign coach. Now, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you look at England in recent times, achieved huge success under two Zimbabweans. There's no proof that, you know, a developed, successful country has to be getting coaches from their own. But it's interesting that sort of at present, Sri Lanka's default seems to be to look abroad.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that is the 57th episode of Reverse Swept Radio, and our third in our new interhemispherical incarnation, as we're calling it, recorded between Sydney and London. I think we can confidently say the only podcast to be recorded in between Sydney and London. There's clearly a lot that's going to be developing in the game over the next few months, and we hope that you can share it here on Reverse Swept Radio with us.